waggled the paper and grinned to himself. "Big shot," he said softly. "The Bat Boy getting jobs for his friends." He looked at his watch and got up. That half case was due down on South Temple at 7:30. After his father had gone out, Chet wandered restlessly around the house. Jeezy Cly, it was all right. 2 months with the Bees, sitting in the dugout with them, eating with them in diners and hotels, meeting players from all the other clubs, guys like Lefty O'Doul and Chief Bender and Walter Mayles. There was the guy with the fast one. Old Bill Talbot was no bush leaguer, for that matter. He'd been one of the best outfielders in the business in his day, and he was still good enough at 40 to hit over 300 and play a good left field more than half the games. He'd been up in the big time a long while, and he knew them all, Ruth and Hornsby and Walter Johnson and Grover Alexander and Casey Stengel and Sisler and Collins and all of them. You ought to be able to learn plenty just sitting and listening to Bill. It was darn nice of Bill to take him along, though probably he thought he'd get his money back in a year or so when Chet made the team and strengthened the pitching staff. It was nice of the old man to speak to Bill, for that matter. Every once in a while he cropped up with something like this that made you think he was all right for sure. Like the night he took them all out on the night of graduation. Laura was still talking about what a good egg he was. "Well," he said, "you made up for plenty this time. This'll make you a good egg for a long time." He had a date with Laura at 9, but he'd stick around now till the old man came home, just on the chance that he could get the car. Laura was going to feel bad about his going. But after all, he'd only be away 2 weeks, and then back for 2, and then away 3. He went into the hall to call her up. Her eyes would stick out on stems. The doorbell rang, a faint, muffled tinkling in the kitchen. Chet looked through the window in the front door, but whoever was ringing was off to the side, and he couldn't see anything. He turned the knob, and the door swung in hard against his chest, pushing him against the wall. "Say, what in—" he said. He was looking into the muzzle of a gun. The man holding the gun came around the door and let 2 others in behind him. Pushing Chet into the front room, he took a quick look in bedrooms and kitchen to make sure no one else was at home. He came back and patted Chet's pockets perfunctorily and motioned him over into a chair. "You sit down and take it easy," he said. "This is a raid. Want to tell us where it is and save yourself trouble?"
"I don't know what you're talking about," Chet said.
The other 2 men were already in the kitchen. Chet heard the feet of one go thumping down the cellar stairs. Because he could do nothing else, he sat in the chair while they went methodically through the house and cellar. All the time they were below, Chet sat still under the eyes of the officious detective with the gun, his ears strained to hear any sound of moving. The preserve cupboard that his father had built so that it looked like a solid wall out from the furnace room, with a little 6x6 room back of it packed with liquor, bottles, labels, seals, alcohol, would be a find if they had sense enough to try to move the shelves. But the 2 came upstairs with nothing in their hands but a sack and some straw bottle sheaths. The 3 of them stood looking at Chet.
"Where's your old man?" one said.
"He's out of town."
"Went kind of suddenly, didn't he?"
the man with the gun said sarcastically.
"I saw him this afternoon."
Chet shrugged.
"Hell with the old man," the second man said. "Where do you keep the whiskey? You'll get off easier if you spill it."
"What whiskey?"
Chet said.
"Oh, for Christ's sake," the first man said. "Don't be as stupid as you look. You aren't pulling anything off."
The blood had drained from Chet's face. He could feel his skin dead and stiff on his bones. "Go to hell," he said flatly. The tableau of the 3 glaring at him was interrupted by a jerk from the little hook-nosed man in the middle. He held up a hand.
"Shh,"
he said. In the garage beside the house, a motor was cut. A car door slammed.
"Round in front, you, Ted,"
the man with the gun whispered. "Joe and I'll wait for him at the back door." Chet wet his lips. He ought to jump and shout a warning. But the deputy had his gun out again. The old man wouldn't have a chance to run for it, and he might get shot. He closed his mouth, but he couldn't stay sitting down. As the back door opened, he saw the deputy spring forward, his gun out.
"I got you,"
he said. He was so excited that his mouth frothed.
"Don't you make a move. I got you, by God."
Caught entirely unaware, Beau stood in the doorway, the sack of whiskey he had been unable to deliver in his arms. His eyes shot from the deputy with the gun to Chet, standing white and still in the other doorway. His lips came together and he breathed once, audibly, through his nose.
"All right," he said. "You're Tom Mix. You got me. What do you want?"
The deputy grabbed the sack and Beau let it go in contempt. It crashed on the floor with a thudding clink of smashed glass. The deputy, showing his teeth, let it lie there.
"You're under arrest," he said. "Possession and transportation."
Beau's voice was perfectly controlled, the voice of a good citizen, annoyingly bothered by officious officers.
"Since when have you started arresting people for having a little liquor around for their own private use?" "Own use, my ass," the deputy said. "Come on, you two."
He motioned to Chet, took a pair of handcuffs from his pocket and shook them. Beau's eyes went narrow and black.
"He's got nothing to do with whatever you're charging me with," he said. "He's just a kid." "Would you like to handle this?" the deputy said.
He handcuffed the two of them together, and for just an instant their eyes met, Chet's smoky, sullen, a little scared, Beau's bleak and gray.
"Don't worry, kid," Beau said. "This smart bastard is just showing off. You'll be out of this in an hour."
"That's all right," Chet said. He went along out to the deputy's car, feeling his chained hand brush against his father's as he walked, and his whole mind was emptied as if water had washed through it. Chapter 7 For an hour after lunch, she had been sitting on the balcony with two women from Salt Lake, one a dancing instructor at the university, the other the wife of a professor. They were very pleasant women, easy to know, their voices quiet. The things they talked about let her for a little while look into a world that had been completely closed to her. The professor's wife had been reading a book by a man named Sinclair Lewis.
"You must read it," she told Elsa. "It's priceless. I should think every Rotarian in the country would be squirming."
"I think it's rather pathetic," the dancing instructor said. "After his boy has run off and married the girl, you remember, Babbitt has to accept it and give the two his blessing. When he said that about never having been able once in his life to do what he really wanted to do, I could have wept."
"The Civil War didn't abolish slavery," Mrs. Webb said. "We're all slaves to something, just like Babbitt. I hate to think of what somebody might write about college professors, plugging along with their minds half on their work and half on a promotion. There are a thousand things George would like to do, but there he goes on reading themes and getting up lectures and going through the same old grind year after year, just getting acquainted with his students' minds and then having them pass the course and vanish. I should think that must be the worst feeling on earth, teaching freshmen in college. You'd never meet any minds but 17-year-old ones. Eventually your own mind must freeze at that level."
"Have you noticed George deteriorating?" the instructor said.
"I notice he never gets his book done. That's where my slavery comes in. He's a slave to his classes, and I'm a slave to the duty of driving him in to work on his book." She smiled at Elsa. "What's your husband a slave to?"
"I don't know," Elsa said. "Cigars, maybe."
She could have come much closer than that, but it wouldn't do. Any consideration of his slavery or her own had to be kept for the nights when sleep wouldn't come, and the thoughts went around in their circular paths, pacing the mind like animals caged. Neither she nor her thoughts had any place in the society of these women who could talk shop freely and openly, criticize their husbands because nobody would dare to think for a moment that their husbands were not respectable and estimable men. You criticized in public only when you hadn't really much to object to. For an instant, sitting in the sweet afternoon sun with these women who read books, went to plays, knew music,
moved in an atmosphere of ideas. She felt a pang of bitter, black envy. It had never occurred to her why the world of criminals and lawbreakers was called the underworld. But it was clear now. You were shut out. You moved in the dark underneath. And if you came up for a brief time, as she was doing now, you knew better than these women who accepted you in friendship as something you were not, that you were an uneasy visitor in a place where you didn't belong. Under other circumstances, these women might really have been her friends. They could have played bridge or mahjong in the evenings, visited at each other's houses, loaned each other books, gone to plays or movies or musicals together. "That's dreadfully true," she said, "that about the slavery."
The mail truck from Salt Lake came up across the bridge and stopped under the balcony. A boy carried the mail sack inside.
"That's what I'm a slave to," the instructor said. She put away her petty point and stood up. "I just exist from one mail to the next. If the truck broke down someday and didn't get here at least with my newspaper, I think I'd die."
She went down after her mail, and the professor's wife held out the Lewis book.
"Would you like to read this? I think you'd like it."
"Why, thank you," Elsa said.
"My son and I have been reading things aloud in the evenings. He'll be going to the university this fall."
She riffled the pages, wondering when Bruce was coming up. He generally came around 3, after he had gone through all his rituals of being a good camper. She stood up to look down the road, and it was then that she saw the Cadillac coming. It pulled into the parking lot, and Beau got out, and she could tell from the very way he walked that something was wrong.
"Excuse me," she said to Mrs. Webb, and laid the book down in her chair. "Here comes my husband."
In her room, she heard him through in silence.
"Well," she said when he was done, "I guess I'd better start packing my things."
"Do you think you ought to?" Beau said. "The doc said a couple of months at least."
"Did you come up just to tell me to stay on here?" she said.
Then she saw that he was hurt. He had run to her the minute he got into trouble, and he had come to take her back, but he didn't like to be told why he had come.
"I wouldn't think of staying," she said. "I feel worlds better. A month has been more than enough."
"I want you to stay right here if you think you need to," Beau said. "There's no point in coming down if you're going to get all run down again."
Out of the weariness that had come back on her, Elsa smiled.
"We'll be moving again, I suppose."
"I guess we'll have to."
He sat on the bed and watched her put her clothes in the bags. He was nervous and fidgety, stood up to look out the window, lit a cigar, let it go out, lit it again.
"That damn show-off pro-y," he said, waving a gun around as if he was catching horse thieves. "I wish to hell Chet hadn't been there."
Elsa turned sharply.
"Was Chet there?"
"Didn't I tell you?" Beau said. "They took him down to the station with me, but they let him loose right away. It was just that pro-he trying to get himself a reputation. I don't think he'd ever made a raid before."
Elsa only half heard him. She wanted to say,
"Oh, my God,"
and sit down on the bed and cry. Instead, she said quietly,
"How did Chet take it?"
"All right. He was pretty white. He just kept his mouth shut till they turned him loose."
"Have you seen him since?"
"No. I didn't get out till 11:30. They didn't take the car because they didn't have any evidence I'd been transporting in it. So I gave Chet the keys. When I got back this morning, the car was in the garage and Chet was gone. I suppose he went to work, or else out to make some arrangements."
"Arrangements for what?"
"I guess I didn't tell you that either. I saw Bill Talbot, and he's taking Chet along this trip."
So it was better, she thought. That would keep him from thinking too much about it. But it was bad enough to have had him dragged off to jail. "That's the part I hate worst about this business," she said, "to have the boys get mixed up in it."
"Do you think I like it?"
"You could have prevented it if you'd quit a long time ago."
His face flushed darkly.
"Kick me," he said. "I'm down."
"That isn't fair," she said, almost crying.
"Is it fair to gouge me when I'm down?"
I'd have done anything to prevent that if I could have.
Bo, she said, let's not fight. I'm sorry, I'm just sick about Chet, that's all.
So you've given up again, her mind said. You've backed away when you knew you were right. You used to have more spirit than that.
Will you go on, she said? Will you keep on backing away until your children are both blackened by this dirty business, or driven to something worse?
She looked at Beau, his face haggard, almost old, the faint lines of bitterness and violence deepened around his mouth. He was miserable, too, as miserable as she was.
But then why? She said. He could have got out of this business years ago.
What is your husband a slave to, Mrs. Mason?
To himself, Mrs. Webb. To himself.
To his notion that he has to make a pile, be a big shot, have $100,000 in negotiable securities in his safety deposit box, drive a Cadillac car, have 7 pairs of shoes with $3 trees for each pair, buy 3 expensive Panamas during a summer, and wear a diamond worth $1,500 in his tie.
He doesn't know, he wouldn't know, what to do with money when he has it.
Would he ever think of going to the theater, or reading a good book, or taking a trip somewhere, just for the trip? He gave up reading books 10 years ago, and even when he goes to a movie, he goes only to kill 3 hours.
Chet'll be all right, he said. I wouldn't worry about him else.
I hope so, she said. He's more sensitive than you think, though. He has to show off a lot and pretend he's older than he is. He lives on the admiration of his pals, and if this gets in the paper, it'll hurt his pride so bad. Is it in the paper?
Not very big, Beau said. It's there, though.
Poor Chet, she said. We'll have to stop at Bruce's camp, she said. Maybe we could let him stay up here.
Moving, we could use him, Beau said.
Well, we'll see.
She took one bag, and Beau the other. At the top of the stairs, Elsa remembered Mrs. Webb and the book.
I have to run up again, she said. I'll meet you in the car.
Up on the balcony, she spoke to Mrs. Webb.
I'm sorry, she said. I guess I won't be able to read your book after all. My husband just came up, and I have to go down with him.
I hope it isn't anything serious, Mrs. Webb said.
No, nothing serious. I may come back in the next few days. I hope so. It's been a wonderful place.
If you don't, Mrs. Webb said, don't forget to come and call. I'd love to see you.
Did I give you my address?
Yes, Elsa said. I hope you'll come and see me, too. Mrs. Webb put out her hand.
It's been ever so nice to know you, she said. Be easy on yourself. You don't want to get sick again.
I feel almost as if I were leaving home, Elsa said.
Will you say goodbye to Miss Sorensen for me?
She broke away and went, and on the stairs she met Miss Sorensen and had to go through it again. Miss Sorensen had the paper under her arm, and as she got into the car, Elsa thought miserably that now, probably, up there in the sun on the balcony, the two would read that news item. Not very big, but there all right. And know her for what she was. Next to her worry about how Chet was taking everything, that was the most miserable of many miserable thoughts. The only consolation was that the address she had given Mrs. Webb would be useless after a day or two. So even if Mrs. Webb missed that item in the paper and came to call, she would find only blank windows and a closed door. At the very least, the underworld could hide. She found more to worry about than even her worst anxieties could have anticipated. When, at the end of a week, that left her sick and spent, she sat down in the afternoon with all of it settled, Chet gone, Bruce off with a friend's family on a tour of the southern parks, Beau downtown making the last of his undercover arrangements that would get him off lightly with a fine. She felt as if she had gone through an earthquake, and the world was still tipsily rocking. Moving hadn't helped any, either. Her curtains weren't up yet. There were boxes still unpacked in the kitchen. The linen was piled on top of the bed in the spare bedroom. The house, like her own life, was upside down, but she couldn't do any more now. She just wanted to sit and cry. Even the realization of how burnt out she felt sent a twinge through her, and she rested her forehead on her hand. "Oh, Chet, Chet," she said, blinking the tears. She had cried enough already, she thought in wonder, so that she shouldn't be able to cry any more. She looked up at the uncurtained room. It was a pleasant enough room, far pleasanter than many she had lived in, but the windows were streaked, the shades hung a little crookedly in their brackets, the rug wasn't down yet, and the furniture was arranged anyhow. It struck her as a cold room, an unlived-in room, as unfriendly to its new occupants as a barn. Whenever she moved anything, the sound echoed. Outside in the stretch of vacant lots that went for a half-block down the street, children were yelling and cars went up and down on the new pavement, but the sounds, too, were remote and indifferent. She was shut up here in this half-lived-in house, hidden behind its dirty windows, in isolation as complete as if she lived in Labrador. The mantel clock said 4 o'clock. It would be pleasant, she thought, to have somebody drop in. Her eyes took in the amount of cleaning and straightening still necessary, and she retreated from her wish, then came back to it again. What difference did the condition of the house make? They had moved in only yesterday. Whoever would be coming would be a close friend. They would have a glass of iced tea and a cookie or cake, and sit and talk a while. It would be a relief to talk. For 5 days she hadn't talked to anyone but furious people, sullen people, stubborn people, tearful people. She had had to play peacemaker to the whole bunch of them, when she would rather have gone to her room and cried. Somebody to talk to. What if Mrs. Webb came around? "Don't be stupid," she said. "You couldn't talk to her, or to anyone except Beau or Bruce. And Bruce is gone for a week, and Beau is still mad enough to fly off the handle at a word. You can sit and let it simmer inside you. That's all you can do." "Now," she said, "you really know what it is to be uprooted. You're as homeless as a tramp on a park bench. You've pulled away from all your family, and you're alone in a room that isn't really yours. You have a father, a stepmother who used to be your best friend, a sister, a brother, uncles and aunts and cousins, but you don't know any of them any more, except maybe Kristen." Psychosocial isolation, her mind said. That was what Bruce had said about the way they lived, one day when they were talking in the parlor by the fire. She had laughed then at the big words and at the half-playful venom with which he spat them out. Something he had got in school, another mysterious world that she saw only in reflections and heard only in echoes through her children. Psychosocial isolation. "Well, whatever you call it," she said to the empty room, "I hate it." "And oh, Chet, Chet," she said, "why did you let it hit you so hard? You were strong enough to bear burdens and strains and fatigue. Why weren't you strong enough to bear shame?" She rose and wandered around the room, picked up the metal elephant on the mantel, brushed the dust on it experimentally, set it down again. There was a box of stationery, 2 or 3 bottles of ink, some pens and pencils in a carton on the other end of the mantel, waiting for time when she could put them away. The clock said 4:20. Beau wouldn't be home till 6, probably. She took paper, pen, and ink, and went into the dining room. Somebody to talk to. The best she could do was Kristen, 1,500 miles away. Sitting with the pen in her hand, she found herself crying again, her eyes running over without effort or strain or sobs, as if she were too tired to cry properly, but had to sit and simply drip from the eyes. And she knew she couldn't write it, even to Kristen. All she could do was think it, wonder why Chet had thrown up the whole works,
even the trip with the ball team, even the chance he had been dreaming about for 2 or 3 years. Why he should be so humiliated and shamed that he would run off that way, take Laura with him, be so sullen and unapproachable when the police finally brought them back. But she knew, really. He wouldn't have anything to do with anything his father had ever touched. He had meant that runaway as a final pulling up of all the roots. He had meant never to come back. He had it in his mind that he couldn't ever face anybody he knew now. If he appeared at the ballpark with the team, he was afraid the people in the stands who knew him would say, "There's Chet Mason. His old man got pinched for bootlegging a while back. He's got a nerve showing his face around." "But to get married," she said, "at 17. To run across the state line into Wyoming and lie about his age 4 years and with only a few dollars in his pockets. To hate his father so bad he would do anything like that, give up his whole ambition just to get away. Oh, Lord," she said, and leaned her head on her hand. The whole business was mixed up and confused, but the confusion couldn't eliminate the certainty of what had happened. It couldn't make her forget the fury Laura's father had been in, the way he gobbled and strangled over the telephone when the runaway had first been discovered, and the way Beau had shouted back at him. He would blame Chet himself and be hard as nails with him, but he wouldn't let Laura's father blame him. And all that argument, and Chet so sullen that he wouldn't speak, and Laura shut up in her house and kept even from telephoning. She tried to think of what she might have said to Kristen if she had written, how she would have told about all that, even the buggy whip that Mr. Betterton had used on Laura, and how she had had to be a peacemaker, calm Beau down, finally go down herself in a taxi and insist that Laura be allowed to come up and talk with her privately. She would have said how she had urged them both to submit to annulment, save trouble by letting the proceedings go through. They couldn't fight it anyway. All they could do would be to make themselves and everybody else unhappier than they were. It was best to pretend that they hadn't been for 2 days, man and wife. They could go back to work and save their money and get married again after a few years, and it would be better. Talking like that all the time with Chet's sullen face before her, and Laura twisting her hands, crying, so frightened of her father that she wailed and said she had to get away, she couldn't go back, why couldn't people have left them alone? But it was Chet she worried about. He was too grim and silent. He too obviously hated Beau. And even if this was smoothed over, she knew there would be other things that Chet wouldn't stay now. It was Laura, she would have had to say to Kristen, who finally weakened. Chet would have stood up in court and shouted that they had lived together and that the marriage shouldn't be annulled. It was Laura who listened when she told them how hard life could be without enough money, how a few years spent saving now might make all the difference later. It was Laura who accepted the promise of help later and agreed to let their fathers cancel the marriage. And it was Laura who convinced Chet. Not, Elsa said bitterly, his mother. His mother couldn't convince him of anything. Only his girl could. And she only because she was so scared, poor thing. And what Chet had said when he finally agreed. "I'm doing this for you, Mom, not for him, and I'm never going to live at home again." She hadn't had the heart to tell Beau that. It would have made him boiling mad, but it would have hurt him too. And she hadn't pointed out to Beau, and this she couldn't have said to Kristen at all, that it was the whiskey business that was the cause of the whole trouble. She knew what his answer would have been. What could he do? He had to make a living somehow, didn't he? How was he going to make up the loss brought on by this last raid? Christ almighty, did she think he liked having the law in his hair all the time? Let him get a little ahead and he'd quit, sure, but how could he quit now? And could he help it if the pro he making the raid was a hysterical damn fool and pinched the kid? Did she think he liked it? Elsa pushed away the pen and ink and stood up. There wasn't any of it you could tell Kristen. It was nothing that could be told. All you could do was shut your mouth and make the best of it.
but the mere thought of making the best of it, reconciling yourself to the thought that your son went white with hatred when his father talked to him, that he had blown all his chances and might never pick them up again, that his sullenness might drive him to any sort of foolish and reckless act, made her bite her lips. Like the last two nights, Chet had been home. Drunk, both nights, she knew. But what could she say? What could she do? What argument could she have used to move him, brace him up, give him the feeling that his whole life wasn't ruined? He was so sure it was. First, his mind seemed to say, Beau had spoiled his life at home for him, and now he had spoiled the only other life that had been open. All right, with both spoiled, he would go to hell as fast as possible. It was silly, it was childish, but it was unstoppable. Unless Chet came to himself, got a decent job up in Idaho, where he'd gone, got on his feet again and hooked up with another ball team, something to give him confidence in himself and the world again. This trouble was only a moment, if he looked at it straight. There was his whole life ahead of him. She thought of what Bruce had said one day at Brighton. He had amazed her then, as he sometimes did, with the things that went on in his mind. People, he had said, were always being looked at as points, and they ought to be looked at as lines. There weren't any points. It was false to assume that a person ever was anything. He was always becoming something, always changing, always continuous and moving, like the wiggly line on a machine used to measure earthquake shocks. He was always what he was in the beginning, but never quite exactly what he was. He moved along a line dictated by his heritage and his environment, but he was subject to every sort of variation within the narrow limits of his capabilities. It was too complicated an idea for her, but it seemed to her now that if she could bring herself to look at Chet as a line and not as a point, she might even be able to laugh. If she could only look back and fix her mind on escapades of his childhood. He was always getting into scrapes, having the neighbors over for drinks during the flu epidemic in White Mud, stealing that gun from Tex Davis's shack, and thinking how big and tough he was with a man-sized 44, getting into trouble years ago back at that home in Seattle, when she had had to take the boys out and go home to Indian Falls. She shut her mind on that, too. There was danger in looking at people as lines. The past spread backward, and you saw things in perspective that you hadn't seen then, and that made the future ominous, more ominous than if you just looked at the point, at the moment. There might be truth in what Bruce said, but there was not much comfort. Chet came home, but not because he wanted to. A week after he and Van went up into Idaho, they got drunk in Idaho Falls and were thrown in the bullpen for the night. When they were released next day and asked to get out of town, they decided to hit for Ashton, up in the high timber country, to see if anything was stirring in the sawmills or placer mines. 10 miles out of Idaho Falls, they hit a pile of gravel and rolled over. Van, wedged behind the wheel, had 3 broken ribs, a broken collarbone, and a badly skinned face. Chet, thrown clear, broke his right arm in 2 places. A passing motorist took them back to Idaho Falls, where they spent all their remaining money for doctor bills. As soon as Van was able to travel, they came back to Salt Lake on the train, their fare paid by Van's mother. For almost 2 weeks, Chet stayed sullenly at home, hardly going out of the house except to the drugstore for newspapers and magazines. All morning he sat with the paper, all afternoon with a magazine, his feet propped on a chair and his sling adjusted across his stomach. Even to his mother he said nothing about his marriage or what had come after it, nothing about how the accident had happened, nothing about what he was going to do when his arm knitted. He did not, so far as any of them saw, have any communication with Laura. Nobody ever saw him use the telephone or write any letters. At the end of 2 weeks, when his arm was out of the cast, he asked his mother for a little money. She had none at hand except a few dollars left from the household allowance, but she gave him that without asking questions. He counted it. $11. "Can you get me a little more?" he said. "$10 or so." "Are you going away again, Chet?" He nodded. "For good," he said.
"Where?"
"I don't know."
"Will you write? Promise."
"All right," he said. "Don't think I'm blaming you, Mom. You've been swell. I'll write to you."
That night she asked Beau for $20. He looked up in surprise because she rarely asked him for money beyond her allowance. But he didn't ask what she wanted it for. Without a word, he dug it out of his wallet, and she slipped it under the base of the lamp by Chet's bed. The next morning, after Beau had gone downtown, Chet came into the kitchen with his suitcase packed. She wanted to hold him, hang on to him, beg him not to go, to stay and get a job in town and forget all that had happened. But his face was so somberly still that she didn't. She was as helpless to keep him with her now as she had been to prevent the whole debacle that had driven him into himself.
"Goodbye, Chet," she said, and felt his arms tighten around her.
There was that comfort, at least. He loved her. Nothing that had happened had alienated him from her.
"You've got so little money," she said. "Why don't you wait and I'll get some more?"
"I wouldn't want more," Chet said. "I'll take enough of his money to get me out of town, and that's all."
"You're bitter," she said, searching his eyes. "Don't hold things against your dad. He feels bad that things worked out the way they did. And if you get in any trouble, or even if you don't, write to him. He'd be pleased to help you, Chet. Do you know that?"
"I guess he won't have the chance," Chet said. "I'm not going to get into any trouble."
"But you'll write. Him, too."
He squeezed her hands, the grip of his left hand hard, that of his right weaker, feeble from the recent injury.
"Take care of yourself," he said.
"I'll let you know where I land."
And there he went, Elsa thought. There he went, this time for good.
3 months later, from Rapid City, South Dakota, she got a postcard. Chet and Laura were married again. Part 8. Chapter 1. From his window on the third story, Bruce could look out over a flat acreage of lights climbing upward to the signboards and the tall mills along the Mississippi. The river itself was a sunken black channel with firefly lights moving mysteriously along its bottom, and against the glow of the St. Paul's side, he saw the superstructure of the bridge he crossed every morning on his way to class. He had picked the highest room he could find, because he hated the flat country. The sky came down too close all around, like a smothering tent, and an eye that wanted to look out was constantly interrupted by buildings, trees, the swell of low hills. Even outside the city, where he had gone, hopefully, on walks, he had found no place high enough to give him a view, no place flat enough to let him see more than a quarter of a mile. The upper-floor room helped some. It gave him a chance at night to pretend that the lights he looked down on were much farther away than they really were, and to cultivate his nostalgia for the high benches around Salt Lake, with the 40-mile valley wide open below him, the state road a string of distended yellow lights on down toward the Jordan Narrows, the slag dumps at Magna and West Jordan belching gobbets of fire on the black slope of the Ochres. He was homesick and almost terrifyingly alone. He ought to go out to a movie or get busy on torts. There were plenty of things to do if he could bring his mind to them. But instead he went and sat on the window sill, opened the sash to let in a blast of cold January air, and sat looking out. "Bruce Mason," he said. "Bruce Mason, first-year law." There was something almost cosmically ironical about his choice of profession. He remembered what Bill Levine, a friend of his father's, had said when he heard it. That big, gross animal with the shrunken legs, sitting in his wheelchair all day with a sanctimonious look on his face, a look that said, "See, I'm a cripple. I have to sell taffy and nuts on the street for a living. A nickel for a bag of nuts will help keep life in a body that the world has miserably misused." And under cover of the taffy and nuts, he would arrange you a woman, sell you a stolen car, get you a bottle or a case, give you a card to the hop joints in Plum Alley, play procurer and pimp with his patient, resigned smile that covered a lewdness as deep and stinking as the pit.
"There's nothing like a lawyer in the family," he had said. "Hey, Harry?"
Bruce shut the window and stood up. "And what," he said, "would you do if you became a public prosecutor and found yourself prosecuting your old man? Would you send him to McNeil Island for 2 years for conspiracy to evade the prohibition law? That would make a nice little problem in family loyalty and public duty. Would you sprinkle dust on Polynices' head or leave him for the wolves?" "If I only understood better," he said. "If I really knew what I think, what I am, what he is and Mother is and Chet is, how everything got off on the wrong foot. If I knew how and why Mother has stood it for over 25 years, I might know something." He got out his mother's last letter, delivered that morning, written 3 days before. It was a good letter, but it told him nothing of what he wanted to know. Everything that was tangled or thwarted or broken in the family relationships was carefully held back. If a man could understand himself and his own family, Bruce thought, he'd have a good start toward understanding everything he'd ever need to know. He laid his mother's letter down and sprawled his legs under the desk. The book on torts was at his elbow. He tossed it over on the cot and reached for a notebook. "This is not a journal," he wrote. "It is not notes for a novel, not a line-a-day record of the trivia my mind dredges up. Call it an attempt to understand." "Understand what?" he said. "Where do I begin? With myself, my father, his grandfather? When did the germ enter? Where did the evil come in?" "I suppose," he wrote, "that the understanding of any person is an exercise in genealogy. A man is not a static organism to be taken apart and analyzed and classified. A man is movement, motion, a continuum. There is no beginning to him. He runs through his ancestors, and the only beginning is the primal beginning of the single cell in the slime. The proper study of mankind is man, but man is an endless curve on the eternal graph paper, and who can see the whole curve? What is my father? What is my mother? What is my brother? What am I?" These sound like fatuous questions, but they occupy our whole lives. Suppose I said my father is a bootlegger who lives in Salt Lake City, is easily irritated, has occasional spells of intense good spirits. Suppose I said he wears a diamond like a walnut in his tie, and another as big as a pickled onion on his finger, that he pays $100 apiece for his suits. Those are observable characteristics. Or suppose I said that all his life he has been haunted by the dream of quick wealth and isn't quite unscrupulous enough to make his dream come true, that he is a gambler who isn't quite gambler enough, who has a streak of penuriousness in him, a kind of dull Dutch caution, so that he gambles with one hand and holds back a stake with the other. He might have made a mint playing the market before the crash. Instead, he bought gilt-edged stocks outright and made less. Suppose I labeled him a self-centered and dominating egotist who insists on submission from his family and yet at the same time is completely dependent on his wife, who is in all the enduring ways stronger than he is. Suppose I listed his talents, a violent stubbornness that butts through things and often overcomes them, immense energy, generally in the wrong causes, a native tendency to be generous that is always being overcome by his developing greediness and his parsimonious penny-pinching. Add a vein of something like poetic talent, a feeling for poetry of a certain sort, as witness his incredible performance last summer of quoting, after a lapse of almost 30 years, pages and pages of Burns that he had learned in the Wisconsin woods. When I have put that down, I have perhaps sketched a character, I have done the sort of thing a novelist probably does before writing his book, but I have not even scratched the surface of Harry Mason. Everything I have listed is subject to contradiction by other characteristics, open to qualification in degree and kind. Everything has a history that goes back and back toward a vanishing point. His history is important. It is important to know that he ran away from home at 14, and why? That he worked in the woods and on the railroad, that he was disappointed in his ambition to be a big league ball player. It is valuable to remember that all his ancestors, as far back as I know anything about them, were pioneers, and that he was born when almost all the opportunities for pioneering were gone. It is necessary to look at his father, about whom I know nothing except that the Andersonville prison spoiled his disposition. Probably it didn't spoil his disposition at all, but only let out something that was already there. It would be as accurate to say that the strain of living outside the law has soured my father's temper. Actually, he has always had it. It's like the tar in tar paper. When it's new and fresh, the tar is distributed, the paper holds it. Under conditions of sun or rain or exposure, the tar begins to lump or ooze out. The process of growing older is perhaps a simple process of breaking down cell walls, releasing things that have for a while been bound up in the firmness of young muscle. And how far back beyond one ought to go, and how infinitely much one could fill in to the bare outline of two generations! I can't, obviously, make even a beginning. What bred that evil temper, and that egotism, and that physical energy, and that fine set of senses, and that manual dexterity, and that devotion to pipe dreams, into Harry Mason, into his violent old father, into the generations hidden down below the eroded surface of the present? To know what Harry Mason is as of January 1931, I should have to know every thought, accident, rebuff, humiliation, triumph, emotion that ever happened to him and all his ancestors. And beyond that, I should have to weigh him against a set of standards to which I was willing to subscribe. That would be understanding. But that kind of understanding can only happen instantaneously in the mind of God. "So where do I start?" he said. He had been writing furiously for 3/4 of an hour, but he hadn't even come to a starting point. Nothing in the whole texture of his life, or his family's life, was arbitrary. Yet he could approach it only by being arbitrary. There were too many things he couldn't know. "All right," he said. "I'll start with the things I do know. I suppose I have always hated him, probably not always with justice. Most children whose fathers are not completely housebroken must have that same hatred in greater or less degree. Yet if a father is housebroken, he is less than God and open to contempt. It must be a hard thing to be a father, to get away with it. A man should have both strength and patience my father never had. I know that I hold things against him that were my fault. Times when I whined or disobeyed or didn't listen. But still, to have one's nose rubbed in one's own excrement, or have his collarbone broken by his father's knocking him end over end across the woodbox, are humiliations that a child cannot easily forget or forgive. It helps not at all to know that your father is often sorry and ashamed after a blow-up. When the child is a crybaby, as I was, the situation gets worse, because the crybaby runs to his mother, and there arises a combination of mother and child against father. I wonder what crybabyishness in a child becomes as the child matures. What is the connection between uncontrolled bawling in a child and uncontrolled rage in a man? It is curious to think that maybe my father, as a child, was a crybaby. My hatred of him seems to arise from two things, his violence to me and his inability or unwillingness to see that he was misusing my mother. It is possible that she has never thought herself misused, though I know she has always hated the liquor business, and has thought that Chet, with another kind of start, would have done better. Add to those reasons my own adolescent snobbishness. I was ashamed of the old man all the time I was in college. I was envious of boys whose fathers were respectable, companionable, understanding, everything that mine was not. I hated the flashiness he put on in his clothes. I hated what I saw as boorishness in his manners. I don't believe we've had a friendly and open conversation since I was 12, and I know he hasn't kissed me since at least that long ago. I think he has been afraid to. It used to drive me crazy, wondering why Mother stayed with him. I have asked her a dozen times why she didn't leave him. I'd get a job and support her. She always said that I didn't understand.
Understand what?
There's only one thing she could have meant, that she loved him. That and her belief that loyalty to your own actions is the highest virtue are the only reasons she would have stayed. She made her bed, and she'll lie in it till she dies in it. That kind of loyalty without love would be stupider than I think any action of Mother's could be. But even without love, it is more admirable than anything the old man can show. I don't think he has ever faced the consequences of an act. He shuts his eyes and gets mad. Chet's the same way, only he never did have a bad temper. It was only when the old man pushed him around that he got hard and mulish. Somehow the tar missed him, and though it seems a mad thing to say, I think he is weaker for not having it. When things go wrong for him, he broods. He was that way at Christmas, having trouble with Laura, thinking about how he had to come crawling back last year and ask charity from the family. It's a pity that he couldn't have stayed with baseball. But once he got his back up, he wouldn't admit his mistake about Laura. If he had, he wouldn't be out of work now, and he wouldn't have had to take that blow in his pride. I could have cried almost at Christmas, the way he's got so gentle with me. He used to be always horsing around and sparring at me and kidding me. Now he's big brother, obviously proud of me, taking me on as an equal, and in some ways, painfully, as a superior. And there was that graduation present he bought me just after he'd come back, when he didn't have a dime and was still looking for work and was still raw from having to ask the old man to help him out. I know he stole the money for that cigarette lighter from the baby's bank, and that Laura found him out when they had a fight. That was a nasty time for him, and I don't imagine it's much better now, driving a taxi. I remember how he was when he came back, after the mine closed down and he lost his job. All day he'd sit in the front room, learning to play a Hawaiian guitar, twanging away on The Rosary, a sick tune if there ever was one, sitting there all alone, wrapped in some kind of personal isolation, while the baby cried and Laura scolded and Mother tried to keep things smooth. There's a defeat in that picture that I hate, because Chet is a good fellow. He'd give you his shirt in zero weather. I guess he missed the old man's selfishness, too, and in a way that, too, weakens him. I hate to see him whipped before he's 24, hopelessly practicing a home course in taxidermy and fooling with that damn guitar. And the dreams, the hopelessly rosy dreams. I remember just after I'd gone back for the holidays when we were taking a shower together and harmonizing in the bathroom. He thought we could work up some songs, go in for a vaudeville act, try to get on the Pantages circuit. He actually had got himself believing it was possible. It isn't, even though he can sing. I don't know why it's impossible, but I know it, and I knew it then. It all belongs with the taxidermy and the dead magpies in the basement and the glue and paper and feathers and the interminable damn guitar twanging the rosary. That's a defeat that the old man is at least partly responsible for. Mother's is another. Yet it's important to remember that he isn't a monster, as I used to think he was. He doesn't tramp on people out of meanness. They get in his road, that's all, or he's tied to them and drags them along with him. He can even be kind, and I guess that now I think of it, I can see why Mother loved him once, and maybe still does. I saw that when she got sick a year ago, when she came out that morning with the queer look on her face and said that she'd found a big lump in her breast. Their eyes jumped to meet each other. And it seemed to me that all of a sudden I could see what living together 25 years can do to two people. They asked and answered a dozen questions in that one look. I remember her operation, too, the way the old man woke me at 6 in the morning to go to the hospital. He probably hadn't slept much, but he couldn't stand it down there. He held her hand while they gave her the ether, and I suppose I was jealous that she wanted him, not me. But the minute they began getting ready, and Cullen came out of the washroom with his scrubbed hands in the air for a nurse to pull the gloves on, the old man lurched out as white as chalk. Once or twice during the operation I saw his face looking in the operating room door, but it never stayed more than a second or two. And when Cullen came back with the slides and said it was malignant, that it meant radical surgery, we had to hunt for 2 or 3 minutes to find the old man. He was sitting out on the fire escape, gray, clear to the lips. He just nodded when Cullen told him, and he never made a move to come in again. If he had, he probably would have fainted, because it was like a butcher's block. Afterwards, he visited her twice a day, brought her candy, filled her room with flowers. He even tried to talk to me about her, and get me to say she would probably be all right now, wouldn't she? There wasn't anything left for cancer to grow in, was there? I'm afraid I didn't give him much help. I didn't think then, and I don't now, that she has more than a 50-50 chance of its not coming back. I suppose I acted cold, but it was only because I was talking to him. I agonized over it enough because I love my mother and respect her more than anyone I have ever met, and that's not anything a psychologist can grin about. Why shouldn't I? There's a positive flame in her, a curious little bright flame that never goes down. But the old man was good to her then. He wouldn't have talked her into going to visit Kristen if he had been thinking only of himself. Maybe he thought that she might not live long, that he owed her a visit home. He suggested that she go through Hardanger and see the people they'd known when they were first married, and just before she left, when Chet and Laura and the baby came in from the mine, he agreed without a whimper to take them in. Give him credit. He's kept them ever since, even if he has grumbled. She enjoyed that trip. Nobody in Hardanger recognized her at first, and she had fun being mysterious and letting recognition dawn on them. They gave her the keys to the town, apparently. That must be a curious feeling, to go back after 25 years and see all your friends grown gray and fat and bald, and count the stones in the graveyard, and know that you've grown older, along with everything else. Anyway, she enjoyed it, and she came back in better health. Maybe she'll get by. Maybe there's a chance that after I finish here I can get her to break loose from that life. She deserves some friends. She deserves a rest. She's had too long a vacation from any sort of normal woman's life. It's an almost marvelous fact that 12 years of living among bootleggers and pimps and bellhops and all the little scummy riffraff on the edge of the criminal class hasn't touched her. Simply hasn't touched her. Neither has the constant sacrifice she has had to make of her own wishes and her own life. It's almost comical to see how completely those small-time thugs respect her. She has been the repository of the confessions and woes of 6 kept women. She's been within smelling distance of 12 stinking episodes. She has had for companions altogether too many foul-mouthed, unscrupulous, lying, cheating, vicious people. But all they have succeeded in doing is to make her kindly wise. For all her yielding and her self-sacrificing, there is something in her that doesn't give when it's pushed at. She only gives up her wishes, never herself. Bruce stretched his cramped fingers and looked up. This could go on all night, and he would be no closer to what he was after. Probably when he read over what he had written, he wouldn't even agree with half of it. He picked up his mother's letter again. No mention of how the double family arrangement was going now. Nothing about how the old man was behaving. Chet had finally agreed to go back to the business school, which he had started once and then dropped. His father was looking at a little sporting goods shop down on 2nd South, with the idea that he might buy it and set Chet up as manager. They hadn't said anything to Chet yet, and it was still only an idea, but she hoped it would come about. Chet was sick now in bed. A week ago they had driven up to watch the ski jumping at Ecker Hill, and Chet had helped push some people out of the snow and had got overheated and caught cold. He was running a little fever, and if he didn't get over it by tomorrow, she was going to send him down to the hospital. The baby was fine. It was wonderful to have a child around the house again. Without moving from the desk, Bruce scribbled off a letter. He had been hitting the books pretty solidly since he